Oh my, is this team really just going to be this bad? This is adjusting for altitude.
Baseball is a difficult game. The average hitter gets on base in less than 40% of their plate appearances. Yet the average pitcher gives up 4 runs every 9 innings pitched. The sport is a challenge on its own. But at altitude, the problems for baseball players compound. Less break on pitches, balls that fly significantly farther than at sea level, and then after playing in such a treacherous environment, the players play in normality for half of their regular season. Adjustments must be made by those who don the purple pinstripes of the Colorado Rockies. We discuss those adjustments here. This is Adjusting for Altitude with baseball fanatic and aspiring MLB general manager, Christopher Nelson II.
Ah, yes. Welcome, welcome to Adjusting for Altitude, the most in-depth quality Rockies podcast on the market, streaming on all your favorite podcasting platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, I don't know. What other podcasting apps people use? iHeartRadio, I guess. That's where you can find this podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by another disappointing week and weekend of Rockies baseball, unfortunately. But I guess it didn't really get much better last week. But if you'd like to go listen to last week's episode, if you haven't already, you should definitely go check that out. I don't know why you wouldn't, unless you're new. And if you're new, welcome to this podcast. We have lots of fun. Definitely go check out last week's episode, though. We discuss a lot of very frustrating things that happened in the previous week of Colorado Rockies baseball. And we made some notable things, or I guess we picked up something that was notable from the game against the Nationals in our home opener. That's what we do on this podcast. We pick up little nitty-gritty things that people who aren't necessarily paying close attention to the game might not otherwise pick up. But I mean, other than that, y'all already know the deal. If you don't follow me on Instagram right now, what are you doing? Go on and do that right now while you're listening to this podcast. It is audio. You can likely switch over to your Instagram application and go add me at I am the second, IamThaSecond. Other than that, how are we doing, ladies and gentlemen? So the baseball season is officially 9 games in for the Rockies, I believe. Well, no, it's actually more than 9 games in. Yeah, we're actually 13 games in. 13 games in to the 2023 regular season for this Colorado Rockies team, and lots of people are not very happy. Well, lots of Rockies fans are not happy with the way this ball club has begun the year. Let's dive into the last and most recent disappointing week in Rockies baseball. This week's Week in Review is underway.
This is Adjusting for Altitude's Week in Review.
All right. So, the Rockies on Saturday evening lost to the Washington Nationals by a score of 7-6. Now, that game was very, very deceptive if you just look and see, oh, okay, it was a close game. Very, very close game, and then we just couldn't quite pull it out. Now, not the way it went. Trevor Williams did pick up the win for Washington in that game. Austin Gomber did take the L for the Rocks in that game as well. But the Rockies were actually losing going into the ninth inning, 7-2. They almost came back with a pretty nifty rally, and they made that one-run game in the ninth inning before ultimately losing, of course, 7-6. In this game, Austin Gomber, like I said, took the loss, 4.2 innings pitched, 7 hits allowed, 5 runs, all of which were earned, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts, and he also surrendered a home run. Bullpen did all right. Connor Siebold came in with 2.1 quality innings of relief, 2 hits allowed, 1 run, 3 strikeouts, and the same with Brent Suter, 2 innings pitched, 1 hit, 1 run earned, 1 walk, and 2 strikeouts. Other than that, the offensive highlights, again, very few and far between, but Jonathan Daza did have a 3-for-5 day on the evening. That was about the only guy who got on base multiple times with a hit, that is. Rockies took the L on Saturday 7-6. Headed to Sunday, the finale of the series, Rocks were looking to play for a split, and split indeed they did. They ended up picking up the win on Sunday, 7-6. Denelson Lamet picked up the win, and Erasmo Ramirez took the loss for the Washington Nationals. That was a pretty good game. A few guys with multi-hit performances, Jerickson Profar, Charlie Blackmon, and Elias Diaz all had multiple hits in this game, and some RBIs as well. Pitching was all right. Ryan Feltner went 5 innings, gave up 6 hits, 3 runs, all of them earned, walked 3, struck out 3. I honestly thought he did fine in that game. But, you know, it is what it is. Jake Bird came in and did not do very well. 0.2 innings pitched, 3 runs, all of which were earned on 2 hits with 1 strikeout. Brad Hand came in, got the other 0.1 of that inning that Bird did not get. He walked 2, but he got a strikeout to end that inning. And then Denelson Lamet came in, pitched an inning. No runs allowed, no hits, no walks, 1 strikeout. Justin Lawrence came in, did something similar. Pierce Johnson came in and locked the game down for, I believe that was, I guess that would have been his third save. Yeah, his third save of the year that Sunday. Rocks picked up the big win 7-6. On Monday, the Rockies kicked off that series with the Cardinals and won game 1, 7-4. Herman Marquez picked up the win. Steven Matz took the loss. Herman unfortunately left this game early with an injury. After 5 innings pitched, having given up 3 hits, 2 runs, both earned, 4 strikeouts. And I believe he left that evening about 4 strikeouts away from being the all-time franchise leader in strikeouts for the Colorado Rockies as well. Very unfortunate. He was also placed on the 15-day IL a few days later. Brent Suter came in relief, 2 innings pitched, 2 hits allowed, 1 run. It was not earned. 1 strikeout as well. Justin Lawrence came in and gave up 1 run in 2 innings pitched. Right, 2 walks, 1 strikeout, not his best performance of the year, but again, nothing to really complain about. The Rockies kind of were in control in this game from the 6th inning on, so nothing really to worry about on Monday's game. Tuesday is where the problems began. The Rockies lost that game 9-6. Giovanni Gallegos picked up the win for St. Louis, and Pierce Johnson took the loss for the Rockies, with Ryan Helsley recording the save for the Cardinals in that game. Kyle Freeland was on the bump for the Rocks in that game, pitching 6 innings, giving up 6 hits, 2 runs, both of which were earned, walking 2, striking out 5, giving up 2 home runs. So this was the first game of the year that Kyle kind of got knocked around a bit. But again, quality start, 6 innings, 2 runs, nothing to complain about there. Jake Bird came in and pitched 0.2 innings again, giving up 3 runs, none of which were earned. And we'll get to that later on in this episode. Denelson Lamet came in, pitched 1.1 innings, gave up 1 run, 1 hit, K'd 3, and walked a batter. And then Pierce Johnson came in that 9th inning. That was disastrous for the Rockies, where they blew the tie. It was tied at that point in time, and he came in and gave up a home run to Nolan Gorman. And that ultimately settled the deal. The Rocks did not come back at that point in time. Connor Siebold was brought in after Pierce couldn't shut down the 9th and got the remaining 0.1 of that inning that Pierce could not. So a very unfortunate 9-6 Rockies loss on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, the Rockies lost again by 3 runs, 7-4. Andre Pallante picked up the win for St. Louis, and Justin Lawrence took the L for the Colorado Rockies, again with Ryan Helsley picking up a save. Pitching, again, it was a Jose Urania start day. 5 innings pitched, 5 hits allowed, 3 runs, 1 walk, 6 strikeouts. So arguably his best, well, not arguably, literally his best performance of the year thus far. He did give up 2 home runs, though, during his outing. Suter came in with some quality relief, and something similar. Justin Lawrence, while he did take the loss in this game, again, another issue that we're going to have to discuss later on in this show, the runs he gave up were not earned. And Connor Siebold, again, came in later in that game just to eat up an inning for that Rockies bullpen. But, I mean, I guess the offensive highlights from this game, Chuck was fine, 2-for-3. Jerickson Profar did hit a home run. So good to see that pop is starting to show up. That's one of the reasons the Rockies signed him. He's a guy who has the potential to go deep out of that leadoff spot. But I mean, guys like Crone, Moustakas, some of these veteran guys just continue to struggle. In addition to Ezekiel Tovar, also went 0-for-3, even though he did pick up his first walk of the year in that game. That about sums up the week in Rockies baseball, though, for now. So we're about to get into this segment of a deeper dive. But before we do, I think I'm going to start doing this thing where I go over the Coors moment of the week. Now, obviously, this will only be applicable when the Rockies are playing a game in town in Denver. But I think it'll be cool to just see some of the little, like I said earlier, nitty-gritty, nitpicky things that you really won't pick up if you're a casual baseball fan. But if you're actually looking close and you understand what you're watching and the circumstances and the context in which you're watching it, you start to pick up a little bit more in depth. So a few weeks ago, I talked about a little bloop single that Aloris Montero hit to center field off of Josiah Gray. Actually, no, it might have been last week. Yeah, National Series. It might have been last week. So never mind. This segment is making another return, although it wasn't a segment initially the first time around. Now it is a segment, the Coors moment of the week, before we get into this week's deeper dive. I believe it was the game on Wednesday. Yeah, game on Wednesday. Brad Hand gets put in relief after our good friend Brent Suter gives us solid 1.1 innings of relief pitching in relief of Jose Ureña, of course. Brad Hand is brought into this game, and I believe the very first pitch he threw to the first batter he faced was a fastball that was low. Now, if you'll recall, if you've listened this long to this podcast, that in the second episode that I did, the one where I did the season preview for the Rockies, I noted that I don't think Brad Hand will have a very good season in a Colorado Rockies uniform, mostly for a few reasons. Number one, I mean, it's just hard. It's hard to be a pitcher coming to pitch with Coors Field as your home ballpark for the first time. It's just hard on any pitcher. I get that he's got a resume of being an all-star caliber pitcher, one of the best closers in the game. But I mean, that was something similar that could have been said about Wade Davis. And we all know how that ended for the Colorado Rockies, and him didn't end very well. An all-star caliber closer being brought to make Coors Field their home ballpark for a lot of money. And unfortunately, you can't pay a guy enough to be able to adapt to those circumstances. Aside from just that adjustment being a very real thing, Brad Hand also throws a very spinny fastball. And as I noted in episode 2 of this podcast, if you throw a very spinny fastball, and by spinny, I mean a fastball that has a very high spin rate, top 35-40 percentile in the major leagues, you're going to be less likely to succeed here simply because of the effects that altitude has on fastballs more than it does breaking balls. Like we said, breaking balls typically move different at altitude as compared to sea level by about a margin of error of 1 or so inches, while fastballs tend to vary at margins of error at around 3 inches in either direction. So fastballs are obviously more impacted. If you can't locate a fastball because you have a very spinny fastball, it's just going to be harder to do that here in Colorado because of the way that altitude impacts that pitch. Brad Hand finds himself near the top few percentiles in the major leagues in fastball spin rate. That was another reason I predicted he was not going to have a good season in a Colorado Rockies uniform. Now, obviously, that's just a very base prediction. I haven't obviously watched a ton of Brad Hand over my lifetime, over his career, because he simply hasn't played for the Colorado Rockies, and he spent a lot of his time in the American League. Aside from, I guess, the Marlins days and the Padres days, he's mostly known for his days as Cleveland's closer during those years where they were competing for postseason spots. Nonetheless, Wednesday's game, he's brought in relief, and the very first pitch he throws is a fastball that misses low. And this is very interesting because you can easily see that he was not trying to throw this pitch low and out of the zone. He was trying to get a low strike called. Brad Hand was trying to throw a very deceptive pitch that kind of just maintained its plane into the lower half of the strike zone and start a count off 0-1. Unfortunately, he missed his location and it was 1-0. Now, these might seem like very, very insignificant moments. But again, for a Colorado Rockies pitching staff that is typically not seen by many people as a very advanced or top half of the league staff, or even with the potential to be such a staff, getting ahead in counts is very, very important. And I'm sure Bud Black would tell you the same thing. It's a problem that a lot of our pitchers, especially some of our younger guys like Ryan Feltner and Jake Bird, have issues with control and command. And that significantly gets complicated when you have a fastball that's very spinny. Brad Hand's spinning fastball missed the strike zone, not because he missed his location, but because he just barely missed his location given his fastball spin rate. And he started off a count 1-0 instead of 0-1. This can cause problems if you're a Colorado Rockies pitcher and if you're a pitcher in general. Why? You like getting ahead of hitters. 0-1 and 1-0 have significantly different branches off of that tree, if you will, that lead to different outcomes in an at-bat. Obviously, it's going to be more likely that if you start a count off 1-0, that batter is going to reach base as it compared to when you start a count off 0-1. So it's those little things that just make the realization of pitching at Coors Field and the realization that that is significantly harder than pitching at any other stadium in Major League Baseball an actual reality. And it does go to show that it doesn't matter whether you've been pitching for several years, 5, 10 years in the major leagues, or if you're a young guy like Josiah Gray, your fastball is going to move differently at Coors Field. And that's just a reality of life on the ground for pitchers who pitch either for the Rockies or for other teams visiting us on the road. But that's my Coors Field moment of the week. Well, how about we dive into this week's episode segment of A Deeper Dive?
It's time for A Deeper Dive.
Okay, so I'm going to start off with the positives because the negatives are way, way too easy. And I'm sure a lot of you are already knowledgeable, well knowledgeable about the biggest errors, no pun intended, or no spoiler intended, I should say, that happened this week. But we're going to start off, like I said, with the positives. Elias Diaz has gotten really, really hot over the last week or so. And a lot of people will just make that observation. They'll just stick, oh, look, Elias is hitting well. Look at this. Fantastic. That's exactly, we knew he could be that type of player. And he's finally, at long last, doing it. For me, that's not enough. I'm sorry. I like to dive into the details of why a guy is doing the things he's doing. So why is Elias Diaz hot over the last week or so? Well, I'm going to tell you. If you notice, earlier in the year, Elias, if, for those of you who've looked at his stance and have observed his stance, you'll know that he sets up pretty relaxed. He sets up with his bat typically on his shoulder, and he's more closed off in the batter's box. That's just the way Elias Diaz is. Personally, I think it's a cool batting stance if it works. Like, again, something can look cool, but if it doesn't work, it does not matter. So I've forever, for the longest period of time, wanted Elias to succeed. Like I've said previously, he's probably just a placeholder until Drew Romo's ready within the next year or so to take over the mantle of starting Rockies backstop or catcher, for those of you who are newer to the game of baseball who might be listening to this episode. But it's been very interesting to see how Elias has made adjustments. Now, I don't know who to give the credit for on this, whether it's Hensley Mullins or some of our other assistants in the department of hitting coach or assistant hitting coach with the Rockies. But I did notice last week that Elias has opened his stance a little bit. Rather than having his shoulders closed off a little bit more towards the plate or even slightly back, he started to open his shoulders so he's more parallel, or I guess from the perspective of his torso perpendicular to the plate, if you understand what I'm saying. So if he's standing in the right-handed batter's box, looking towards the dugout, he's looking a little bit more into the field of play, if that makes sense. If you understand the perspective I'm trying to paint, he's opened his stance a little bit more. And it's really paid dividends for him. Why? Because when you have an open stance, you are not required to open your hands and have hands that just need to be the quickest things in the world. You can slow down your mental clock. You don't have to be worried about getting your hands in the right position fast enough. There's a little bit more wiggle room with an open stance. And Elias has definitely thrived on that opening of his stance. It's allowed him to get that bat head through the zone in a lot more relaxed manner. It's allowed him to stop putting the ball on the ground because he's chopping over on it, and instead he's been able to put more baseballs in the air and hit more line drives, all because he has a more open, relaxed stance because of the opening that he made with that adjustment. Two guys I'd love to see employ this very similar tactic are Ryan McMahon and Ezekiel Tovar. For those of you who have watched any amount of their at-bats thus far this season or over the course of their career, you'll know that both of them have very closed-off batting stances. and it seems to affect them quite a bit. I know I do a lot of complaining about the fact that Ryan McMahon cannot hit a high fastball to save his life. And again, that was demonstrated very clearly this week. 2-2 count, 1-2 count. He's too easy to set up with a breaking ball low, fastball high, or vice versa. It's too easy. Easy strikeout. Like, it's not hard. So I know I do a lot of complaining about that, but that is simply because Mac's batting stance is too closed off. He needs to take a page out of Elias Diaz's book and just open the stance a tad bit. It'll allow his hands to get through the zone faster. So when he recognizes high fastball, his hands are just more on time. And at the very least, he can foul off that pitch rather than just swing right through it. Something similar with Ezekiel Tovar. I love Zeke. Obviously, Zeke has climbed right on through the major league system or the minor league system to get to the major league team. He's only 21. He's like the second youngest player, I think, on an active MLB roster to start the season. Zeke, I love the fact that you've torn through the minor leagues. However, you've now reached the major leagues, and a thing that is important about reaching the highest level of the game is understanding how people are going to attack you. To start the season, it seems like Ezekiel has had trouble adjusting down to off speed and breaking pitches. And this is obvious in the fact that he simply is not on very many off speed pitches. And then when people do throw him the fastball, which he wants to hit, he just swings right on through it or he's late. That's mostly attributed to his timing mechanism, which again has improved over the last week or so that I've noticed, or based on what I've seen. Nonetheless, he does need to open that stance a little bit. I think if he opens that stance, he already has plenty quick hands, and some of those soft little hits that he's getting, whether it's a ground out or a chop out or a soft pop out, those will start turning into better hits for the same reason they have for Elias Diaz. Only thing is, Tovar has faster hands than Elias Diaz has. So you can just imagine the potential that Tovar possesses if he just opened his stance up a tad bit, was able to see the pitcher with a little bit better perspective and just open up and just, it'd be amazing to see how that little adjustment would change his life. So those are the positives. And I think those are things that could significantly help those two guys in Tovar and McMahon who have struggled to start the year at the plate. It's already worked for Diaz. I see no reason why it wouldn't work for them. We're about to get into the next topic here on our deeper dive in just 1 second. Stay tuned. Welcome back to this week's episode of Adjusting for Altitude. Earlier in the year, I compared the Colorado Rockies in 2023 to both the 2019 Washington Nationals and the current Baltimore Orioles. I said that I noticed a lot of similarities between our team as currently constructed and both of those teams from both of those years. The Orioles are obviously a much younger up-and-coming team with a few solid younger players who are ready to make the adjustments necessary to contribute to the success of the major league team, and I expect them to compete for a wild card within the next year or so. The Washington Nationals from 2019 were a team that really nobody expected to do anything after the first two or so months of the year, but ended up putting together a very nice stretch run to end up winning the World Series in 2019, the year after losing their best superstar player, arguably the best player in that franchise's history, in Bryce Harper. Nonetheless, I figured that the Rockies might actually have a chance to replicate something or to show some signs of similarities to either of those ball clubs, either with young guys who are ready to contribute at the major league level and are showing significant progress in their development, again pertaining to the younger players, or the Nationals team, where you have veteran guys who are able to step up when they need to and put together years that nobody really expected them to put together. But they did nonetheless, and that would end up leading to success. I expected the Rockies to demonstrate at least some hope that either of those would be possible. And I think to some extent they have, but it's certainly nowhere near the level that I would have expected it to be. The bottom line is the Rockies, ladies and gentlemen, are simply bad. They're just a bad baseball team. And we can hold out hope for them as long as we want to, but based on what we've observed thus far in the year, I really don't see any hope for this Rockies team as currently constructed with the current roster and the current major contributors being anything more than bad. You see, there's a difference between good teams and bad teams, obviously. I know. Shocker, shocker. Good teams are good. Good teams find ways to win. Bad teams aren't just bad. Bad teams find ways to lose. This is why the Rockies are bad. The Rockies have found ways to lose baseball games. And it's been quite incredible because this is not a style of Rockies baseball or circumstances endured by Rockies baseball in many of the last few years, quite honestly. We've been a pretty bad team, all things considered, over the last 3 or 4 years, but we haven't been bad to the point where I think we are finding ourselves in this year. The Rockies just simply find ways to lose, and that was demonstrated very well in the Cardinals series. Like we said, in game two, the game they lost 9-6, they at one point in that time came back. They had a 5-run fifth inning. 5-run fifth. They were up 6-2 after 5 innings of play. After 6 innings of play, same thing, because no team scored in the 6th inning. They were up 6-2 with 3 innings left in this baseball game. And they turned it over to a bullpen that you figured would get the job done. And I think ultimately they did their best. I don't understand Jake Bird getting all this playing time. I get that he's got potential as a reliever, and he was a guy that we did draft and who was brought up through our system. I don't think he has the tools necessarily to succeed with Coors Field as his home ballpark, but nonetheless, that's fine, I guess. That's not necessarily where the game was lost. The game was lost when a very, very critical error was made in the 8th inning, I believe it was. That's when the error was made, right? McMahon, easy play to end the inning, boots a very routine ground ball at second. Very routine. And this just caused problems. It's just little things like that that just bother the heck out of fans, right? Honestly, it bothers the heck out of people who just enjoy the game of baseball. Like, that's not a hard play to make. But it happened at not only just a bad time, probably the most inconvenient time it possibly could have. There's just no reason for such an error to happen at that point in time. And I get that's part of the game. Errors happen and such. But good teams, or teams that find ways to compete, do not find ways to lose themselves games by making critical errors when errors simply don't need to be made. The same thing can be said about the game on Wednesday, when again, the Rockies found themselves in a very, very tight situation late in the ball game. I think it was the 8th inning again, actually. I don't remember if the McMahon error was in the 7th inning or 8th inning of the Tuesday game. It was one of the two. Nonetheless, I do remember the one on Wednesday because I was able to watch that game. Wasn't able to watch the Tuesday game, but I was able to watch the Wednesday game. 2 outs in the 8th inning. Justin Lawrence is on the bump. He's pitching fine. He's all right. I think he gave up a double in that inning. Nonetheless, he got himself to 2 outs. 2 outs. And he got a very soft ground ball again to the left side of the infield. For whatever reason, CJ Krohn figured that it might be a ball he needed to field. Even though McMahon was there and going to be able to get there, given that he's not a slow player and he's got plenty of speed to get that ground ball that was slowly hit. Nonetheless, they both run towards it. Krohn eventually realizes that McMahon's going to get there before he does. So now he has to run back to the bag to be able to be in a position to receive a throw to get the out. And that doesn't happen. The runner beats Krohn to the bag and it beats the throw to Krohn at the bag. Great. Very next batter, 2-run home run. There was no runner on base at that point in time. I don't know if I clarified that. I don't remember if Lawrence gave up a hit beforehand and they got a double play or whatever it was. But the point is that was a 2-out runner with the bases empty that then led to the very next batter hitting a 2-run home run for the lead. That was just not good at all. It's little errors like that this Rockies team makes more often than the plays that they make to win themselves games. in these close situations, which is why, very plain and simply, they're a very bad team. Now, there are other reasons why this Rockies team is just a bad team altogether. The pitching staff has very questionable depth, and the pitching depth that they do have, aside from their questionability, just from the perspective of their resume, what their capabilities are, their stuff is not encouraging. Like, for instance, I like Connor Siebold. Connor Siebold has potential to be a solid reliever or starter for the Rockies, either way, however they want to use him. He's got the solid potential for it because of his pitch mix. He's got fastball, slider, curve, or fastball, slider, changeup, rather. And that's the mix that we want for a pitcher to succeed at Coors Field. Unfortunately, his fastball isn't amazing. He struggles with command at times, and it's averaging only 93 miles per hour on the season. Couple that with a slider that's pretty good, that's fine. Unfortunately, his best secondary pitch has been his changeup, at least according to the scouts who have seen him. Unfortunately, you can't set up an effective changeup without throwing an effective fastball. And an effective fastball is not a fastball that's slower than major league average and that you can't control or command. Something similar with someone like a Jake Bird. A Jake Bird is fine. He's got potential. He's got a solid pitch mix with the fastball, cutter, curve combination that he's got going. Obviously, the fastball is mid-90s, so that's solid. You'll love to see it. The control can be questionable at times, but again, younger pitcher, that's expected. The cutter is really going to bother you, though, because he does not throw a slider. The slider is the secondary pitch that not only the Rockies need to be using, but I think Major League Baseball in general is realizing that they need to use as a whole. I think I heard the other day that slider usage is way up as compared to previous years, and curveball usage is down. So the league is seeing the value in throwing an effective slider now. And to see a guy like Jake Bird being put in big situations as a guy who doesn't throw a slider at all, it is not going to be beneficial for this Rockies team really at all. He doesn't really throw that curveball a ton of the time, which effectively means he's left throwing just a cut fastball and a fastball. And this is not good. It's not encouraging whatsoever. On top of the fact that for whatever reason, like I've said previously, I love Buddy Black. I think he's a solid veteran manager for this team. I think he takes some heat sometimes about the fact that he leaves guys in on the mound longer than they need to be. But even then, I get that. This is a developing team. He wants to build confidence within those guys to work through the struggles that they may face, the adversity that they face in game. So I'll give him some leeway on that. But there are some very, very questionable decisions that, again, if you don't understand the context, you're not going to be as frustrated at, but you should definitely be frustrated at as a Rockies fan. For instance, I believe it was the Nationals game on Sunday where he brought in Brad Hand. Yeah, he brought in Brad Hand, and he brought in Brad Hand with the bases loaded, I believe. I believe he brought him in with the bases loaded, and that move doesn't make sense. They needed a lefty, and he didn't bring him in with the bases loaded. He brought him in after Jake Bird was in. And he brought Brad Hand in to get, I think there was back-to-back lefties in the Nationals lineup. He brought Hand in to get those two lefties out. Hand ended up walking both of them. I honestly, to me in that situation, before I even knew who they were going to put in, I realized that there were two lefties coming up. And I was like, this is a very obvious Brent Suter situation. He's proven to be the more consistent lefty thus far, working that effective fastball changeup mix, even though it's not very high velocity. He's demonstrated decent enough command, more command thus far in the season than Hand has. I don't understand why you'd make this move here mid-inning. Hand's the type of guy you want to put in to start an inning, not the type of guy you want to put in mid-inning. However, they brought Brad Hand in, and he didn't do very well in that particular outing. I think he gave up a run or so. Again, all the runs probably were doxed to Bird. I have to go look at the summary again. But the bottom line is, bringing a guy like Brad Hand in as the lefty you want in a situation where you know he has issues throwing strikes, instead of a guy like Brent Suter, who has demonstrated very good control and ability to get soft contact thus far this year, just doesn't make a ton of sense. Something similar with the the bringing in of Jake Bird against the Dodgers earlier in that week. And I think I mentioned that on last week's episode too, but it just doesn't make sense to bring Jake Bird in such a situation with the bases loaded and two outs, needing to get a guy who's good at hitting fastballs out. It just doesn't make sense. And it doesn't make even more sense once you realize that there's a little bit more of a backstory to this too. I don't know what it is about Jake Bird pitching in LA. I know he went to school at UCLA, so maybe there's something related to that involved. Maybe he has people that show up to watch him when he's in LA, and that makes him nervous. I don't know what it is. I'm not going to speak for him. But I do know that in his rookie year, he was brought in a relief appearance with the bases loaded and two outs against LA. And whether it was a pass ball or if it was a straight walk, whatever it was, he ended up giving up at least one run in that outing. I think he gave up one more. I think he gave up two before getting out of that inning for the Rockies. Bottom line is, he has already demonstrated in his career, his very short career, that bringing him in bases loaded situations, high leverage, especially against a good team like LA, is not his strong suit. He's not a guy who's going to go in and thrive in that situation. And he still has stuff that he's working on. So again, this team just finds themselves in some sort of teeter-totter between being a team that wants to win and being a team that wants to develop confidence in their guys to become bigger contributors in bigger roles than I think they're ready for, even just skill set wise. I'm still trying to find that game from the Nationals because now it's frustrating me because I do believe Brad Hand walked in a run. Yeah, he did. He walked in a run. That gave Washington a 5-3 lead. He actually walked in two. He walked in two runs. Yeah, so I was right. He was brought in with the bases loaded. Yeah, he was brought in with the bases loaded in that inning and he walked in two runs. Bottom line is, it's just moves like that that don't make sense based on the player's proven history that demonstrate that we understand how to win, even if it's showing confidence in guys to go get outs. What are you trying to do? It seems like there's a disconnect between the management in-game and the front office and the ownership, because front office and ownership does believe this team can win games. Like I said, Dick Monfort, obviously, went public, said this team can win 81 games. That's great and all, but you have to know how to win games in order to win games. And you don't win games by bringing in guys who have proven that they can't handle certain situations into those certain situations when they arise. So I think ultimately they do need to find arms that fit the mold of a guy who can succeed at Coors Field. I've already talked about this several times on this show. It doesn't even have to necessarily be a guy that fits my ideal mold. Again, that's fastball, slider, changeup, fastball somewhere between 94 and 97 miles per hour with a lower spin rate, somewhere around major league average, like in the 2200, 2300 RPM range at max. Someone with a slider velocity that's about 86 to 89 miles per hour, which is around MLB average in spin rate, around 2500, 2600 RPMs. And with a changeup, that's 84 to 87 in the range of about 1600, 1700 RPMs. That's my ideal Coors Field pitcher. So I'm not even talking about guys going out and finding guys right now that have all those skill sets. That's obviously a long-term thing. That has to be a scouting department shift in approach. I'm not even talking about that right now. I'm just talking about finding guys within the system who possess at least one. I'm not even asking for all three or even two, just one of those pitches that they can command well, and then building off of that and then putting them in situations throughout the course of their minor league career that allow them to use those pitches effectively so that when they eventually do potentially get a chance to play for the major league team, they have a role that they can be put in and that they can thrive in. So they're not trying to figure things out in situations that they're not used to. Rockies also simply need to make a commitment. They need to make some sort of commitment. This team is not going to be good. So by the end of this season, not even by the end of this season, actually, by the end of summer, around July, August, this team needs to figure out, are we going to commit to the youth movement? Are we going to pursue a route that someone like a Baltimore or a team like Baltimore is pursuing this season, or are we going to try and win baseball games? Because you can't get both. When you try to do both at the same time, you get this weird little funk where you're like sort of competitive, but you're not, but you find ways to lose games, but then you find ways to like be competitive. It just doesn't make sense. And it's very convoluted. And soon enough, the fans do get upset about this if this becomes the status quo. So the Rockies do need to make a commitment by the end of summer. Are they going to commit to the youth movement? Are they going to bring up the guys like the Zach Fiends, the Drew Romos? Are they going to fast track the guys like the Gabriel Hughes, who fit the ideal mold of a pitcher who can succeed at Coors Field? Are they going to fast track him and get him ready to potentially compete for a major league rotation spot as soon as 2024, 2025? Are they going to pursue the youth movement and just commit to the prospects that they've developed if those prospects continue to show the signs that they can contribute at the major league level in a timely manner? Or are they going to try and fix these holes, which they've already kind of tried to do, but have kind of not really succeeded at doing thus far? The Rockies need to make a commitment. And I think if they pursue those two objectives some point, or rather during the course of this season, and they get a better understanding of where they fit in those realms of managing this ball club and this organization, I think they'll find themselves better off and they'll have a better sense of direction rather than simply being this team that just finds themselves in this awkward middle ground, probably trending more towards being the bottom half of the league as it pertains to being a team that can compete. We'll wrap this episode coming up next. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Let's wrap up this week's episode with the week ahead.
The week ahead.
All right. So the Rockies are in Seattle this weekend to take on the Mariners. They're currently playing game one of that series tonight. I believe the Rockies are losing 2-1 as of me recording this. Hopefully that changes sometime soon. But on Saturday, game two of the series starts at 7:40 p.m. Mountain Time. That will be a Ryan Feltner versus George Kirby game. Ryan Feltner, obviously, for the Rockies, and George Kirby for the Mariners. On Sunday, the Rockies take on the Mariners again in game three of the series. That game starts at 2:10 p.m. Mountain Time. No starter has been announced for the Rockies yet because that would be Herman's spot, except for Herman was put on the 15-day IL earlier this week. So we don't know who's starting that game for the Rockies. Maybe Connor Siebold, maybe Ty Block. I don't know. We'll find out, though. And Luis Castillo will be on the bump for the Mariners in that game. The Rockies then head home to Coors Field on Monday to take on the Pirates. Game one of that series on Monday starts at 6:40 p.m. Mountain Time. No starters have been announced, but it'd likely be Kyle Freeland for the Rockies. I don't know who it would be for the Pittsburgh Pirates. On Tuesday, the Rockies take on the Pirates in game two. That game starts at 6:40 again. In that game, it would likely be Jose Ureña on the bump for the Rockies. No pitcher has been announced for the Pirates. And on Wednesday, Rockies wrap up that series with the Pirates. That game starts at 1:10 p.m. Mountain Time. Likely going to be Austin Gomber on the bump for the Rockies. And again, no pitcher has been announced for the Pirates. Then the Rockies head up to the Northeast to take on the defending runner-ups of the 2022 World Series in the Philadelphia Phillies. Their first game on Thursday starts at 4:40 p.m. Mountain Time. Likely going to be Ryan Feltner on the bump for the Colorado Rockies. No pitcher has been announced for the Phillies thus far. And then the Rockies play game two on Friday against the Phillies. That game starts at 5:05 p.m. Mountain Time. And on the bump in that game for the Rockies is again an unknown, because that would be Herman's spot in the rotation. And Herman is obviously on the IL. But that is the week ahead for the Colorado Rockies. Thank you for listening to this episode of Adjusting for Altitude. I hope you enjoyed. And if you did enjoy, I suggest you share this with your friends, your family, your Starbucks barista, anybody you come in contact with this upcoming week. If they like baseball, this is the podcast for them, especially if they are in the great state of Colorado and are Colorado Rockies fans. But until next week, I hope you guys stay safe, stay cool, and go Rockies.
This has been Adjusting for Altitude with Christopher Nelson II. If you are indeed a fan of Colorado Rockies baseball or simply a fan of MLB content, Follow this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform and share this podcast with your friends and family. Baseball in Colorado is a complicated situation, but it is certainly not unsolvable. Until our next episode, take care and go Rockies.